It is the Pastor's Heart and Dominic Steele and a Freedom for Faith update on the sea changes in euthanasia, equality, conversion therapy and religious freedom. Monica Dumit and Mike Southen are our guests. The next 6 months are going to be bumpy for religious freedom issues here in New South Wales, Australia. There's a rollout of euthanasia in our state starting in just a few weeks' time on the 28th of November. And then the proposed ban on conversion and suppression and independent Alex Greenwich's Omnibus Equality Bill, plus a finalisation of the Australian Law Reform Commission inquiry into religious schooling and particularly whether or not religious exemptions to anti-discrimination law should be removed or not. Monica Dumit is Director of Public Affairs and Engagement for the Catholic Church in Sydney and was one of the presenters at the Freedom for Faith conference today here in Sydney. And Mike Southen is Executive Director of Freedom for Faith. Monica, perhaps we can start with you and you could just kind of give us an introduction to this sea change that is happened over the last 5 years and continuing to happen. And what's going on?
Well, if we look back to the to December 2017, where we had the introduction of same-sex marriage, I think all of us thought that that was a big watershed moment in terms of social change here in Australia. But what we've seen in the 5 to 6 years since that transpired is a number of different laws changing all on critical social issues, whether that's abortion, euthanasia, prohibition on so-called conversion practices in some states, limitations of religious freedom. It seems to have happened all in the last 5 or 6 years. And so there's certainly been a wave of legislation that's challenging for churches and for Christian ministries. And if we're looking at New South Wales, as you mentioned, we have the implementation of euthanasia beginning later this month. We will have the introduction of the government's proposed ban on conversion practices. We've already got the legislation tabled by the independent member for Sydney, Alex Greenwich, that seeks to amend a whole range of laws in the name of equality, and at a federal level, the Australian Law Reform Commission looking in. So there are a lot of things happening in the next 6 months. It's a very critical time.
You were acknowledging today that one of the things that have been going on is the loss of moral authority of the churches in the community, and particularly the Catholic Church there.
Well, I guess, yeah, what I was saying is that the end of 2017 saw the finalisation of the Royal Commission into institutional responses into child sexual abuse. And for those who remember that time, it revealed obviously a lot of shocking and terrible details of sort of crimes and cover-ups within institutions. And I think something like out of the complaints, 60% of those related to religious institutions, and of that 60%, 60% related to the Catholic Church. And so I think when a lot of these social issues were coming up before parliaments, there was often a loud suggestion that churches should be quiet, because if they didn't have their own house in order, how dare they be speaking about moral issues anywhere else? And so I do think that that contributed to, I guess, the muting or the silencing and sometimes self-censorship of some in church leadership in relation to some of these social issues.
Mike, let's talk euthanasia first. It's going to be messy when it starts here in New South Wales later this month.
Yes.
It's how messy? When we say messy, what do we mean?
Well, there's a lot of questions about how it's going to be implemented. I haven't seen full guidelines around implementation. One of the real messy bits is going to be in how we can choose not to be involved. Doctors should be able to conscientiously object and not be involved in euthanasia. But there's a lot of power dynamics, there's a lot of complexity in whether or not at the time they're going to be able to say, I don't want to be part of this, if, say, their boss is saying that they need to be part of this. We've got a lot of complexity or concerns for institutions themselves, like a retirement village. So a Christian retirement village like Anglicare, who doesn't want to have
and
people.
Let's face it, many of the providers of aged care services are provided by the faith care sector.
Yes, absolutely. And most of them come from Christian traditions who hold that life is sacred and we should not be actively taking life. And they don't want that happening on their property. These institutions started as expressions of faith to care for people who were needed. They're not just service providers to do whatever the person wants, and they wanted to be able to implement their faith and hold to their faith on their property. So at the moment, there is no space for conscientious objection for those institutions to say, actually, we don't want this on our property. So a Christian retirement village likely is going to have to be storing drugs of death on their property in preparation for somebody who is going to voluntarily die, and the institution can't say that that doesn't fit with what we believe.
Mm. How are you in the Roman Catholic space navigating this, Monica?
Yeah, well, look, what we're trying to do is hopefully get a united approach because you have a whole number of different aged care providers. Some are quite large and are open to and cater for people of, you know, many faith backgrounds. And some are also almost community-based where it's sort of a certain migrant community have their own little small aged care facility. And so there are very different...
Just down the road here for years, there's a Greek Orthodox aged care facility and caring primarily for people of Greek Orthodox background.
Yeah, exactly right. And so the question for me becomes, should those people of the Greek Orthodox community be able to live out their final days in a place where they can be certain that there aren't going to be lethal drugs on site? Mm-hmm. So often this is pitched as sort of the institutional right against the individual patient or resident. Mm-hmm. But actually it's about whether or not a group of residents can come together and say, we want to live in a place where this isn't going to happen. Or for families to say, we want to entrust our parents or our other loved ones to a place where...
Confident that there's not going to be institutional pressure to go in that direction.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the only way that you can do that is if an institution has complete rights to opt out and not this sort of halfway house that the legislation puts us in, which says, well, you can opt out as an institution, but you have to allow other people to come on site in order to consult on euthanasia, to make assessments, to deliver and administer lethal drugs.
So what's going to happen 28th of November when it all, the doors open, when the legislation says go and, yeah?
Well, look, I imagine that we'll see in the faith-based institutions what's happened, I think, in other states, which is that it's not taken up by a lot of the residents because they're going in there with a particular perspective. And also I find what the faith-based facilities have been quite successful doing in other places is when a resident starts speaking about euthanasia or assisted suicide, they're able to bring in all of those other supports and say, okay, well, what are you actually asking for? Are you asking for euthanasia or assisted suicide, or are you expressing some type of fear, some type of pain that's not actually being managed well? And are there other things that we can do to assist you in that and to give you good, holistic end-of-life care, give you real dignity in death, not the fake dignity in death that's being sold by other activists? The one thing I will say, though, Dominic, is that it's actually not clear how this will play out because Victoria has had euthanasia and assisted suicide for a number of years, as has WA. But neither of those jurisdictions require faith-based facilities to allow this on site, nor does Tasmania. So New South Wales is actually...
That's New South Wales is worse, tougher, more anti-Christian than Victoria or... how did that happen?
It's extraordinary, isn't it? So I actually don't know how it happened. And if I'm being honest, in some of the private conversations I've had with members of parliament, they didn't even realise that the aged care facilities didn't have these
exemptions,
didn't have these protections in place. Yeah. And so they said, oh, no, you got your protections. I was like, no, we didn't. The amendment was voted down. But that's what happens when legislation like this is getting pushed through and MPs are there to all hours of the evening on successive days. I think, unfortunately, there is a little bit of a tendency of we just want to get this over with.
Roll
we know
over,
it's going to
reject
pass.
Reject all the amendments, yeah.
Reject all the amendments. And I think what my Archbishop described it as is a winner-takes-all approach. So mm-hmm. once you realise that you have the number to that you have the numbers in Parliament to pass the legislation, there doesn't seem to be any willingness to be open to amendments or protections or things like that. It's just a bit of a winner-takes-all approach, yeah.
Now, junior doctors are also put in a particularly difficult position here.
Yes.
Mike?
Yeah, and there is, in any kind of work, there's power dynamics, but a junior doctor has to do, you know, is constantly doing the sorts of tasks that the senior doctors are telling him to do. Senior doctors have got their career in their hands in many ways. They control their promotion paths, their future training, specialization, things like that.
So
there's
don't
a lot
rock
of influence.
The boat.
So
yeah.
Don't rock the boat. And so a junior doctor can say, I'm a conscientious objector, and that's fine, and that's fine, until the day that the senior doctor says, who's under stress, knows he has to go do something, doesn't have time to do it, grabs a junior doctor and says, you go into that mm-hmm. room and do it. And that's the moment of crisis. What do you do?
Okay, next one, conversion practice legislation.
Yes.
And there was a significant pre-election promise from the Minns government at the various Freedom for Faith forums across the state.
Yes.
Give us the picture of what the pre-election promise was. Let's start with you, Michael.
So the churches around New South Wales, 35 different electorates, they had a candidate forum. And in most of those candidate forums, there was a Labor candidate. And most of those candidate forums, they asked the question, if you are going to implement a conversion therapy, will you protect religious freedoms? Will you use the Victorian model? And we knew that Alex Greenwich was bringing up his legislation. We're asking, will you use Greenwich's model or are you going to do something else? And so the Labor candidates were actually all given a script by head office to answer, and they committed that they would not use Alex Greenwich's model. They would not use the Victorian model. They would not ban prayer. They would not ban preaching. And most helpfully, they would not ban consensual requests for help.
Mm-hmm.
So that was what was built into the script that most candidates stuck to one way or another. Chris Mintz himself attended an event in Parramatta, and he attended his own candidates' forum in Kogarah. And he made the same sorts of commitments, that we would let you make your choice and go and ask for help if that's what you want.
So where are we now, Monica, in the negotiations with the government on this?
So a few months ago, the government ran a private consultation, so they didn't put out a consultation paper for public review. They gave it to a handful of, I guess, interested parties, including the faith communities, I would say, including also the LGBT community and others.
Mm-hmm.
And that consultation paper outlines a number of questions and a number of proposals to which we were invited to respond. From what I understand, in the preparation of that consultation paper, they weren't given or didn't have access to the promises, the pre-election promises that Mike just referred to.
That's what they said.
Which does sound astonishing to me.
It does.
I mean, it beggars belief, really. Yeah.
In that meeting, they said, we went online to find what promises we were going to be, and they found Chris Minns's promises, but they didn't find the fuller promises that a lot of the candidates were making. But they didn't seem to be thoroughly briefed to be, these are all the promises that Labor has made.
So at the moment, they've gone back to the drawing board, having been reminded that this was the promise they took to the election. Is that what's happened? Or
we don't know what they've gone back to. So we've had a lot of meetings, a lot of productive meetings with MPs, ministers, Attorney General, Premier, explaining what our concerns are, what we're looking for in a balanced legislation. We want to prevent against coercive harm, but we want to protect religious freedom. We've had all these conversations. We've been heard. They definitely have heard us, but we don't know what's happening. We haven't seen any legislation. We've heard a statement in the media that legislation is coming in November. Well, it is November, and we haven't seen a draft. We haven't had any consultation. So we genuinely just don't know what's going on.
Mm. Monica?
Yeah. My hope is that, in good faith, they will revisit the proposals in that consultation paper and come closer to the pre-election commitments mm-hmm. That were made. I think that If I'm being frank, I think that I've been quite impressed by the sincerity with which the government has approached this issue, and sort of their promises of being faithful to those pre-election commitments. And so I'm hopeful that the legislation, the draft legislation that comes out later this month, will reflect those promises.
Mm. Now, suppression seems to be the word that is causing most angst amongst my Christian friends. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. Well, when we talk about conversion practices, that's really changing from one to the other end. So what is sold in the media or described in the media is trying to change somebody's sexual orientation from homosexual to heterosexual. And we know in the past that that's been linked to some quite abhorrent practices that are against the dignity of the human person. But when we talk about suppression, there is the likelihood that that will actually be seen as really anything that asks for sexual restraint. So anything that says, no, you shouldn't act on those sexual desires that you might have or those sexual attractions that you might have could count as suppression. And this isn't even an issue about homosexuality. This applies just equally to heterosexuality as well. So
I'm just thinking about the 1 Corinthians, flee from sexual immorality. Do you know, there's a verse in the Bible.
That's so sexual suppression.
So preaching 1 Corinthians 6, just that's going to get us in trouble?
It's interesting because at least the consultation paper and some of the language from the government says you're allowed to preach it, but you're just not allowed to tell somebody that they can apply, that they have to apply it to their lives. So you can preach it generally, but you can't tell somebody then that should influence the way that they behave. So your preaching becomes an academic exercise.
So most churches, there's education in preaching, there's education in small group discussion, mm-hmm. and there's education in one-on-one Bible reading, yeah, and prayer.
Yeah, so the one-on-one would definitely be out, and potentially the small group as well. So I'll give you just a very benign example. Say you have a married heterosexual man come to you and say, look, I've met another woman, I'm really attracted to her, I'm tempted to cheat on my wife and
as the pastor I say, resist temptation.
Yeah. That could be seen as suppression. And expose you not only to criminal but also civil liability, which is a very strange idea.
I mean, that feels like unintended concept. I mean, it seems just bizarre that would be put forward. Yeah.
I don't think it's unintended. Mm. This was brought up in the debates around the Victorian legislation as well. And they went ahead knowing full well that this is how the legislation would be interpreted.
And more than that, they specifically said that's how they want. So besides, in case you feel like we're catastrophizing what this legislation is, this is the legislation that's in Victoria. And the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission, VEROC, have got a website which says what you can and cannot do, what would be a conversion suppression practice, and what wouldn't. And they specifically say that encouraging somebody to live in chastity, because otherwise, apart from having sex within marriage, is a suppression practice and would be unlawful. Specifically said on their publicly accessible website, they give examples of the sorts of prayers that are acceptable. So a prayer that is acceptable is it's acceptable to pray with someone and thank God that they are perfect as they are and accepted by God as they are. It is not acceptable to pray a prayer that indicates in any way that they could be broken, need repentance, or changing the way that they live. So it's their website.
So this legislation is going to run foul of, well, the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, the Presbyterian. Keep going. Fill the list out for me.
Muslims, Hindus, the Jewish communities as well. This isn't only an issue for Christians. And when it comes to Catholics, I was saying in the presentation, and I'll repeat it here, this could also affect the Catholic Church saying to their priests, you need to be celibate. Because that would also be technically a suppression practice. Mm. So,
I mean, that's a big thing.
it's a big thing, but I would say what Mike was saying is probably even bigger, because this is the state dictating what you can pray. Mm-hmm. Is there any greater example of overreach or impingement on religious freedom than telling you what you can and cannot pray, who you cannot can and cannot pray for? It is extraordinary.
Yeah. And the VROC website goes on, it talks about preaching. So there is an exemption in Victorian legislation that you can preach what you believe, unless it's directed towards an individual. Mm. And the VROC website says, if you are aware of somebody in your congregation who is struggling with same-sex attraction, your sermon could be considered to be directed at that individual. So even just the fact that you're up in the pulpit saying the Bible calls you to live this way sexually, that actually could well be a suppression practice if you knew there was someone in your congregation struggling with that issue. And that's, again, public website. That's what they've said. This is the ruling.
And I think what it is, I think there's a great misunderstanding of what religion and what faith is supposed to do. It calls all of us to conversion. Mm. I mean, that's the message. Repent and believe in the gospel. Like that's what we're called to. And so this idea that conversion is somehow some awful practice that goes on. No, we're all called to conversion. We're all called to conversion daily, to conform our lives closer to Christ. And so this idea that somehow this is some barbaric practice, it speaks really to an ignorance of religion and the importance of religion in people's lives, I think, by those suggesting these laws.
And again, not unintended consequences, because we've had one MP who's pushing this very hard, an activist, and has said publicly that he wants to not only ban conversion practices, but the beliefs that underlie them. So this is an intentional attempt to silence people who disagree with a specific worldview on sexuality.
What about the issues of gender identity, Michael?
Gender identity gets even more complicated because it's a medically contested space as well as being a theologically contested one. But in the current proposal that we saw from the Department of Communities and Justice, it does not separate between gender identity and sexuality in the legislation. It says it is illegal to embark in this sort of conversion or suppression practice on the basis of sexuality or gender identity. So everything we've said applies with somebody who comes up with you, including a minor, who comes and talks to you and says, I'm not sure that I'm the gender that I'm born with. Any attempt to say, even wait and see what's going to happen and the face of the proposal that's come would be a suppression practice, because the best thing to do for a child who says that they're a different gender is to immediately treat them and immediately give them the puberty blockers and all the treatment that they need. So anything that says wait is a suppression practice. We have had...
And yet so many kids actually go through phases and
absolutely
upgrade this.
Another group who are really upset about this actually are the LGB groups. So gay and lesbian groups who are saying a girl who goes through gender confusion will often grow up to be a very happy, healthy, gay, lesbian girl. And so they are very concerned about pushing kids in very confused situations through a gender transformation. But when we're talking about like the conversion and suppression legislation, what it's saying is it is restricting our ability to even talk about all these realities. We have had an example of a family member in Victoria who wrote to their other family member who was planning to go through gender transformation and wrote, I don't think you should do this. I don't think it's a good idea. And the Victorian Equal Opportunity Human Rights Commission wrote to that family member saying, what you did was a suppression practice and likely to be unlawful. So we're already having examples of, in another state, commissions clamping down on people, on just family members saying, maybe you should wait. Don't do this. A concerned grandparent, uncle, parent, can't have those conversations.
Sorry, Monica.
Yeah. I was just going to say, and one of the important things is that in a number of jurisdictions overseas, we're seeing the opposite happen. So in the UK, in Sweden, in Norway, in other places, they're saying we're actually going to outlaw giving children puberty blockers because we consider them to be experimental. We don't know the long-term effects of them. And so on the one hand, we've got jurisdictions that are prohibiting pushing children down a gender affirmative path. And here we're about to do the opposite, which is say, well, we're going to outlaw anything except a gender affirmative path.
Which is extraordinary when, if you've got, we're going to outlaw doing anything except this, and yet one of the Australian medical defence insurance companies is pulling back from insuring doctors to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. So MDA National announced that as of the 1st of July of this year, they were going to not provide insurance coverage to private practitioners who prescribed cross-sex hormones to kids under 18, I think maybe even puberty blockers as well. I'd have to double check. But they're saying, and they said it's not an ideological, ideological issue. It's actually a financial one. The risk to the children is unquantifiable at this stage. And so simply from a financial point of view, we can't quantify the risk we're undertaking by backing doctors who are prescribing these. So if you have the insurers saying this, if you have jurisdictions in other parts of the world putting the brakes on all of this and saying, hold on, we don't know what's going on here, let's slow down, I think it makes it even more egregious that New South Wales is looking to go down this path.
Mm. Let's just jump over to anti-discrimination for a minute. And I was alarmed at something you said in your presentation about the Anti-Discrimination Board potentially in the future being able to initiate investigations without a complaint about something that had been said in a sermon, go looking, investigating. Tell me about that, Monica.
Yeah, so amongst the proposals and what we see in the Victorian legislation as well is the idea that the Anti-Discrimination Board will be given the power to conduct what they call own motion investigations. So they haven't received a complaint, but they would think, okay, well, we think there might be a systemic issue of conversion in some institution. We'll off our own motion go and start investigating that, and they would have the power to compel witnesses, to subpoena the production of documents and other things like that. And I would think if they're looking into systemic issues of conversion, then their first targets are going to have to be religious groups.
Absolutely.
And churches. And so I would expect, empowered by this, particularly if they hire more staff in order to do that, they're going to be looking for something. And you would have the potential of a letter from the Anti-Discrimination Board saying, we would like copies of your sermons that you've preached on this issue or anything like that, so we can judge for ourselves whether or not there is a systemic issue of conversion within your church. And look, I would dare I say, if there's a pastor who doesn't have a systemic issue of conversion going on in their preaching,
everybody is going to be preaching, turn back to Jesus in this area of your life or that area of your life. You're a rebel. You need to repent. I'm a rebel. I need to repent.
Absolutely.
Yeah, if you're not calling to conversion, if you're not calling to repentance, you're probably not being faithful
to the scriptures,
So I think we've got a real systemic issue that that's going to keep the Anti-Discrimination Board busy.
Mm.
And this proposal was from Alex Greenwich's omnibus bill.
I think it was also in the consultation paper.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the Alex Greenwich omnibus bill, that also included, I think, when you come to gender change and somebody saying, I want to change gender, no need for any kind of surgical change. I just declare. And so you could end up on under that proposal with me not being able to define who gets to search my body at the airport. Is that right?
Or me being able to define who searches my body at the airport.
Right.
So I define myself as a woman.
And then I go through the thing.
I'm saying, I'm a woman today. I've done the paperwork. I go through. I go beep. They say, you need to have a strip search. And I say, well, I'm a woman. I want a woman officer to search me. Thank you very much.
And then an Islamic woman who's working on border security is put in a very difficult position.
Absolutely. She's at least under Alex Greenwich's proposals, she's got no grounds to say no, because that would be discrimination for her to say, well, as a Muslim woman, I'm not going to touch a man's body. Would be discriminatory because I'm a woman. I'm not a man.
Mm.
Same problem with single-sex schools. Even at the safest legislation of saying this can happen at the age of 18 plus, there's heaps of 18-year-old kids still doing the HSC. Mm. And so single-sex schools have a massive problem. But then the legislation talks about what, you know, about the conditions that it can happen at 16-plus or even younger. And it doesn't even require necessarily a parent's support. You can get the court to agree with the child, and there you go. They're now changed their gender.
And even at 18 residential colleges at university, I mean, we've all seen the reports into what goes on at some of those residential colleges. Do you think anything's going to be better by mixing the sexes in those? Who's going to be safer? Mm.
And you can guarantee there's going to be a couple of guys who are going to try it on. Mm. Mm.
That's just under the Greenwich one, or is that under the government one?
That's under Alex Greenwich's omnibus proposal. So sex self-ID was not part. The government proposal we talk about is specifically conversion therapy, and it was a proposal from the Department of Communities and Justice. And I do emphasise that point because at the moment we haven't seen a proposal from the Labor Party of New South Wales.
Right.
We've only seen DCJ's proposal, which was requested by the government. And so there is still space for us to say, Labor have not even suggested they're going to be breaking our promises at this point. They've had a proposal put to them. We are calling on them to reject that proposal wholesale. And because if they accept the proposal, then they will absolutely have broken every one of their promises. But so I think it's important to draw that distinction. But the sex self-ID is one of Alex Greenwich's omnibus bill, which includes a conversion therapy legislation.
And so you're hoping that that will be rejected outright. Oh, sorry.
Look, absolutely. But I think, as I understand it, the Labor government, even if it doesn't support the sex self-ID provisions of the Greenwich Bill, have indicated that they will do their own, that as a party position, that this is something that they support. So it's not...
That's the self-sex ID thing.
Of some form. Yes.
Of some form.
Chris Minns has said every other state has done it, which is a classic argument for jumping off the Harbour Bridge. But that is a statement that he's made and a commitment that he's made. And of Greenwich's omnibus bill, if you split it out, you can split it out saying there's the conversion therapy section. Okay, let's put that over there because the government have committed to not use his conversion therapy legislation and are writing their own, and we know that's going to happen. The second set is a whole lot of changes that's made to discrimination law. And it's a lot of them are very broad changes, which would make it almost impossible to make distinctions between people, particularly for faith organisations. But the New South Wales government have initiated their own review into discrimination law and have committed that they will not implement any of these changes with the discrimination law until that review's happened. So we can, again, park that for a little bit, be very concerned, because we don't know what this review is going to come up with, but then the sex self-ID is something that Alex Greenwich has written and the government has, in theory, committed to. It's actually quite a concerning piece of legislation. We don't know when that portion will come up. Alex's bill has not been split up, I believe.
There is a separate conversion practices bill?
Yes, but the rest is still all together.
The rest of it is still all together.
So they're not yet in the position to just pass sex self-ID, but it would just need splitting the bill and then starting to debate it. And that's plausible to have happened within the November sitting.
It is plausible. And there are other things in the Greenwich bill that are also concerning. There are things like in relation to prostitution. So prostitution is already decriminalised here in New South Wales, but there are some limits on things like advertising, whether or not you can solicit outside churches or schools or things like that. And what the Greenwich Bill seeks to do is to remove even those very minor barriers so that there would be nothing to prevent somebody soliciting for sex work outside or even inside a church or outside a school or something like that. So to remove even those slight community taboos around prostitution. So that's something that's very strange and very, again, I think concerning out of the bill.
You've been promoting a website, Contact Your MP.
Contactyourmp.org.au.
For people to contact their MPs about it.
Yeah, it's a fairly self-explanatory name. So this is specifically, at the moment, the website is specifically about the conversion therapy legislation. It is a website to give you, that will help you write call or meet with your MP. It's not connected necessarily with any one faith or denomination, but it's for everybody to go. You can search for your MP. Postcode search gives you talking points so you can write your letter. It gives you guidelines about how to do it. You can find your MP's email address on there. If you wanted to go and have a meeting with your MP, it takes you step by step for the whole process, understanding what a meeting would be like. Here's the email to send to the MP asking for the meeting. Here's some talking points. Here's a two-page document that you can walk through with your MP with our concerns and our requests laid out. And authorised and approved by 15 major faith organisations. This is the concern about conversion therapy is a multi-faith concern. As we already said, Muslim communities, Hindu communities, Jewish communities are all really, really worried that they can't preach what they believe. So this site's been designed to help every community to go and speak up. The reason being that politicians don't know what we're concerned about until we tell them. Mm-hmm. They don't have great polling. And so the only way that they have an idea of what their electorate is they get a feel of the electorate by the people who come and talk to them, by the letters they get. And we, particularly the Christian church, have really withdrawn from doing that. We're not keen to write letters. We're not keen. And so people think that we don't actually care about this issue. Mm. It's not hard to write a letter, and it makes a big difference, particularly when 100-odd personally written letters come through an MP's office. They notice.
Great. Monica, Michael, thanks for coming in.
Sorry. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Monica Dumit is the Director of Public Affairs and Engagement for the Catholic Church here in Sydney and was one of the presenters at the Freedom for Faith Conference here in Sydney today. And Mike Southen is Executive Director of Freedom for Faith. My name's Dominic Steele. You've been with us on The Pastor's Heart and we will look forward to your company next Tuesday afternoon.
Hey, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, we would love it if you could hop over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating and review. That helps us in the rankings and lets other people discover The Pastor's Heart. And again, if you are able to help us out by being a financial partner, go to our Patreon link, patreon.com/thepastorsheart.